The next case on calendar today is Tate versus State Board of Medical Examiners, case number 61283. We have Jacob Hafter as counsel for the appellant and Bradley Van Rye as counsel for the respondent. Are counsel ready to proceed? Please do.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Jacob Hafter, and I have the honor of representing James Sherman Tate, Jr., MD, before you in this matter. Today we are asking the court to consider two primary issues. The first is an issue which is individualized to Dr. Tate, although the arbitrariness of the disciplinary decision and process is quite frankly unfortunately felt by many physicians across the state. The second issue has broad implications for all allopathic physicians in this great state. This case has its origins from an altercation which occurred between the family of a 14-year-old who Dr. Tate treated as a trauma surgeon when he was left alone for a weekend and was injured by a car. It is noteworthy that the altercation occurred after Dr. Tate discharged the patient and after Dr. Tate agreed to transfer care to a burn specialist for the patient's road rash. The altercation consisted of an exchange of words, the specificity of which are debated. They're contested. And Dr. Tate pressing his forefinger against the chest of a 56-year-old grandmother who trapped him against a wall so that the doctor could escape from that altercation. There are differences in opinion about the stories, the story of the altercation. The medical board believes, however, that Dr. Tate engaged in conduct which brought the entire medical profession into disrepute by actually engaging in the altercation, despite the fact that he was charged, admittedly, by the father of the patient, and that he was trapped against a wall, and nobody at the hospital came to his aid, not security, not another nurse. Ultimately, the matter came before an administrative hearing. The hearing started with two counts against Dr. Tate, one that involved patient care and one that did not involve patient care. Immediately at the beginning of the hearing, because the medical board had no medical experts, they agreed that the first count, the count that involved patient care, should be dismissed. Nothing was discussed at the hearing about the first count or about patient care. The hearing then proceeded. The mother of the patient stated that she did not think worse about the medical profession because of the altercation which occurred between Dr. Tate and her family. And at the end of the hearing officer issued his opinion, finding that Dr. Tate did not engage in conduct that brought the medical profession into disrepute. The hearing officer also commented about the fact that the statute that remained as the basis for discipline, NRS 630.3019, that requires or says that a physician can be disciplined for engaging in conduct, including without limitation, that which violates a code of ethics that was adopted by the board, that because the board had never adopted such a code of ethics, the board should adopt a code of ethics. It's interesting to note that there's a typo in my opening brief in a footnote one. That statute was adopted by Senate Bill 91 in 2001, not 2011. So that statute's been on the books now for 12 years, and it serves as the catch-all for discipline for the entire medical board whenever they want to go after a doctor, but they may just not have enough to get us there. At the adjudication, the board found that, disregarding what the hearing officer said, that Dr. Tate was guilty of conduct which, among other things, had an adverse effect on patient care. This is plainly wrong. Basic principles of fairness and due process require that one cannot be found guilty for violating Medical Practice Act for conduct for which there was no notice or opportunity to be heard. Patient care was never an issue, and therefore Dr. Tate cannot be found guilty for engaging in that conduct. The second issue is more thought-provoking. It's related to the fact that the board has never adopted a code of ethics. That's the rub. The There was a major source of contention before the hearing. There was motion practice, emails between Mr. Van Rye and myself about this very issue. What was the standard that Dr. Tate was to be held against for engaging in conduct for disrepute? No different than if you're disciplining a child, any discipline, any organization should be very willing to at least let you know what you're going, what you cannot do, what is defined as wrong behavior before you go and discipline a doctor or a child or an attorney. The record shows Mr. Van Rye said disrepute behavior, well, it is what it is. This cannot be correct. This court cannot condone a standard for which the practice of medicine is equivalent to that of pornography. The hearing officer made some comments. If you look at the record at Tate 16, says that the word disrepute, because it's in Black's Law Dictionary, meaning that it's a loss of reputation or dishonor, and that reputation is the esteem of which a person could be held in by others. They're not hard to understand words.
Mr. Hafter,
yes.
The hearing officer found in one direction, the board reversed. Unless I'm not seeing something, I don't understand except for the statement by one board member, because it didn't seem to be any real discussion as to why the board did what they did. Could you explain that?
That's why we're here, Your Honor. I mean, that's the real problem, is that I have a strong problem with the way the medical board disciplines its doctors, and maybe that's one of the reasons why it's so difficult for this state to attract and retain good doctors. We have a reputation for harming doctors, for destroying doctors, whether it's within our hospitals and the medical staff actions that occur, which subsequently get reported to the National Practitioner Database, or the board.
This was an open meeting, correct? So it was posted and held in public?
Absolutely.
And was there any discussion as to the motion that was made other than the prior discussion stating that it was when the board member's statement was an incorrect statement?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't. And what's even worse is if you look at the record, I tried to stop it. I tried to say, can we talk now? And I was told no, because patient care wasn't an issue. It shouldn't have been something that was a factor for why Dr. Tate was found guilty of violating the Medical Practice Act. But we weren't allowed to speak. And by the time we were allowed to speak, he was already found guilty, and at that point it was just a sentencing issue.
Well, there was no evidence. The only evidentiary hearing that took place in front of the hearing officer, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the hearing officer made a series of findings, including that the verbal altercation does not support a finding that respondent is guilty of disrepute. Right?
Even in light of an arbitrary and, in our opinion, vague definition of what disrepute
is. But bear with me for a minute. That is his finding, his app or her, I don't know whether it was his. Applying the understanding of that standard to the facts that were developed and the testimony about what happens in emergency rooms with trauma physicians and so on. So when it goes up to the board, there is no more evidence, correct? It's all
correct,
evidence.
Your Honor.
The record comes from the evidence that was presented before the hearing officer?
Yes, they have a binder in front of them.
What is the standard of review that the board should apply to the hearing officer's factual determinations, A and B? Is the finding that this didn't amount to conduct putting the medical profession in disrepute entirely one of law, mixed question of fact and law, or question of fact?
That's a fantastic question, Your Honor. I'm going to say that for the first part, it's my understanding that the board has the choice to accept, reject the hearing officer's recommendations for any reason that they feel is appropriate. They're supposed to rely on the evidence at the hearing, but there's no clear indication that that is indeed the standard. They have the freedom and the autonomy to do as they wish under 630. Notably, they do not, unlike the osteopathic medical board that falls under the Administrative Procedures Act that governs like 15 boards, they don't fall into that. They have their own, the medical board has their own standards. With respect to the second question, that's why we're raising this issue about the concept of is the statute which is being enforced here, is it vague? Because we think that's a question of law. Applying the statute to the facts, I think, is more of an application of the facts and based on the factual pattern that underlies.
Is the answer, though, that under the statutes applicable to the medical board owes no deference at all to findings by the hearing officer?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I don't necessarily agree with that because it's kind of begs the question why even bother to go through with the hearing before a hearing officer. I mean, the notable issue is if we lose, the board gets all of its fees and costs for defending this entire procedure and for bringing it. If we win, we get nothing. I mean, Dr. Tate has to bear the burden of the vindictive prosecution at his own expense. That's why we need clear statutes and unambiguous standards. And that's why I'm asking this court, even though I quite frankly and respectfully recognize that decisions of whether or not something's constitutional are questions that this court may not always like to address. I'm asking that this court do address that because the physicians in this state, they don't get an opportunity if after all the dust settles to be able to recover the fees for defending themselves before these administrative hearings. If there are no other questions, I'd like to reserve my time.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Pickering, and Your Honors. If I might address some of the issues that have been raised, I think the courts have really struggled with perhaps what this court is struggling with and why there is deference given to the board's discretion in reviewing a hearing officer's recommendations. And what I mean is, none of you are physicians. A hearing officer is not a physician. A lot of the cases help define unprofessional conduct or professional misconduct statutes by the ability of the common and shared understanding of the board members as members of
a profession. Mr. Van Rys, even in a self-regulated industry like the legal industry, there is a code of conduct. Why isn't the failure of the board to adopt a code of conduct make the determination of disrepute rudderless?
Why doesn't it make it rudderless?
Mm-hmm.
Number one, because it's not mandatory. Number two, because it's all-inclusive. When you read the statute, it says including without limitation. Again, the legislature looks like it's trying to give the board its discretion to review these actions, these potential disciplinary actions, on its own accord. Now, there is case law in Molnar that says that the board is to examine credibility of witnesses, for instance, but as to the substantive conduct, which is undisputed really in this case, that there was an altercation, et cetera, that's for the board to make its determination based upon.
The hearing officer's determination as to credibility of witnesses is binding on the board, is it not, unless there is no substantial evidence, or am I mistaken on that?
No, I believe that would be accurate.
So the board did owe some deference to the hearing officer on findings of fact.
Right, and that would be as to the credibility issues, which in this case are very limited. Where was the altercation? Where did it take place? What were the exact wording? What was the verbiage used by the particular parties? Did grandma, the 56-year-old grandma, restrain her son?
Counsel, I asked counsel for Dr. Tate similar questions, but that's what I was trying to find out. We have the board re-examining this issue, but the record is silent in terms of questions or comments or findings of credibility or lack thereof. We don't know what was on their mind, what got discussed. We have no idea, good, bad, or indifferent, from the board when they reviewed the record that was presented to them.
As to the board?
Yes.
Well, there is a transcript from page 111 to 141, and there's about...
They talk, speak on the record as the credibility of the witnesses.
Off the top of my head, I don't recall, to be honest with you.
Did they speak to the actions or what they disagreed with as to the hearing officer? Why they found something more compelling than that?
I don't recall. I would say that there was a discussion as to this conduct. There was a discussion as to what transpired at this event.
My understanding is the discussions that pertain to the conduct pertain to the dismissed count, and there were statements specifically by Board Member Ruthie that were kind of adopted by the rest of the board, and that was it. Then they came back with their findings. So, you know, I don't know what that deliberative process was. Mm-hmm. The deliberative process is supposed to be part of the open meeting. There's very little evidence of that in the record.
All right, and I would submit, Your Honor, that as to the count one being dismissed, the transcript of page 115, page 119, was indicated that count one was dismissed, which included the patient care portion. As to count two, for the adjudicating members, which was led by Dr. Fisher, was open for discussion. It was, of course, recognized that count one had been dismissed. That was on transcript page 119. Dr. Fisher also reiterated, this is in my brief, reiterated that the disrepute only was to be considered as well. I cannot speak to as to why there was not further or more extensive discussion. I think the answer would be, in generality, they're not lawyers. They're board members.
But the problem is the only articulation on the record went to the subparagraph 6 issue, in that the point of disagreement between the board and the hearing officer seemed to be that this could have impacted patient care, not simply disrepute at large. And I think it was Board Member Ruthie said more on several different occasions that it went to, she was concerned about the impact on patient care. And then there would be a dialogue, well, but that's not issue before us. We're not doing that count under 6. We're under count 9. But then I don't understand from the transcript why the board disagreed with the hearing officer's mixed fact-law conclusion that this did not bring the profession in disrepute, and the witnesses to it, the patient's father and his mother, both said in their estimation it didn't have amount to a hill of beans on disrepute. It went to, they were mad and he was mad. It's a hard record to get disrepute out of.
That's for your legal determination after the fact. And I would say that the deference owed to the board is common shared knowledge and understanding. It's up to them to make that determination.
What about the board's deference to the hearing officer? It's the same question.
Well, I would say that to defer to a person who is not a physician takes the power away from the board, right? I mean, the board is mostly physicians. Cases that review disrepute-type statutes talk often about we need to let the board make these substantive decisions. That's how I'd answer that.
So your point would be that the board did not owe deference to the mixed question of law and fact with respect to this event didn't rise to the level of bringing the profession into disrepute, that there was no deference owed by the board to that determination by the hearing officer?
I would say absolutely. He overstepped his bounds a little bit there. You know, the board is in a position to review the transcript, to review the substantive testimony, and to make its determination. But the hearing officer, overstepped his bounds a little bit here. He's supposed to make recommendations as to credibility. Who do I believe based upon which disputed testimony?
But counsel, we have a board who's taking an action, and I'm looking at the transcript, pages 120, 121, 122, and there's nothing there. Ms. Ruthie makes a statement, there's some other statements, but nothing as to belief or non-belief, then a vote, and it's done. Mr. Hafter ask if he can make any kind of statement. He's told no. In discussion, we have a vote. We're sitting here and saying, what happened? What was this based upon? Whether we like it or dislike it, is there a justification of the board's action? Ms. Ruther was queried that part of her concern had been dismissed, but there's nothing else there. So how do we know what facts the board relied upon except there was a motion, it was voted upon, and that's the end of it?
You mean other than the transcript?
I'm looking at the transcript, sir.
Other than the hearing transcript?
Yes, I'm looking at the transcript before the board.
Let me clarify. Other than the underlying hearing before the hearing officer transcript, are you then saying that there's no evidence for the board?
Well, I have no idea what the board relied upon because they made no record in the public meeting as to reliance except for a misstatement by Ms. Ruthie as to standard of care.
Yeah, you know, and I would simply say that the board members were polled. Did they review the transcript? They were polled. Did they review the synopsis?
Well, this is supposed to be, it begs a question. This is supposed to be an open meeting. So if the inclination is something was done outside of this meeting, a discussion, and not on the record, then I have even graver concerns than what's given to me by looking at the face of this document. But if I accept your proposition that they were just polled merely to see if they had read the document, then I'll accept that, but it brings me back to my query. I have no concept of what they understood or didn't understand to make this ultimate finding on a vote when half of the motion was incorrect.
I agree with my colleague here because I'm looking at the motion that she makes and she says, which had a negative impact on the quality of care. What about due process? Was he prepared to defend on quality of care when it was dismissed by the hearing officer? It wasn't an issue of quality of care. It was an issue of bringing disrespect to the medical profession. And she's making a motion about quality of care. I just don't understand where that came from.
Well, I can't speak to why Ms. Rusey said it. Unfortunately, I can't speak to that. I'm sure I speak to the fact that allowing a lay member to add portions of a dismissed count to an alive count that everybody knows is alive, I mean, I think that's a twisting of the law, and I don't think that's appropriate. I think the arguments as to due process in that scenario are slight. But it may not address what you're asking, Justice Chairman.
Well, I worry about if I was in Hafter's position and trying to defend him on bringing disrespect, disrepute to the medical profession, all of a sudden they're talking about quality of care in a motion, and there's no discussion about the motion. It's just there's a motion. In fact, I've never seen where somebody makes a motion in a second, there's no discussion, where they would at least have Loudon and Fisher and all the other votes, all the other people who are voting, to say why they're voting that way.
And I would, Justice Cherry, with all due respect, I would point, Your Honor, to transcript page 119 through 122. It's not an extensive discussion, but there is some discussion as to...
Counsel, there's not, I beg to differ with you. There's not any discussion. There's a motion, and that's the extent of it. Quite candidly, I have it before me. I'm looking at it. I've read it twice since you've been standing there because it's so short to make sure I didn't miss something, but there's nothing to miss. So I guess... I'll let you respond.
I have no response. Thank you.
Mr. Renner, I just have one question here, and I think everybody's covered their concerns. From the record, it appears that the hearing officer did not feel there was sufficient evidence that Dr. Tate pushed the individual with with his finger, yet the board, I guess, concluded he did, if I understand it correctly, and I don't understand how they can make that leap. If they delegated the fact-finding to this hearing officer, and that was his conclusion, how can the board, you know, switch that? Do you have any thoughts on
that?
That's
a valid question. In the real unique position of the medical board in these cases is the hearing officer is simply solely responsible for credibility of the witness,
right,
and provide a synopsis of the testimony.
Right.
If he starts doing these other claiming these other percipient facts, it's not helpful to the board. The board is supposed to make that determination.
But whether he pushed this person, I think it is germane to the whole circumstances, you know, the swearing and all that. So it would seem to me that would be something you would delegate to the hearing officer to make those factual determinations, and the board could, you know, it goes from there. But correct me if I'm wrong. That's kind of my take in reading this.
In your custom of practice as a judge, that may be your experience with other boards, but particularly in this instance, that's not what the statute authorizes the hearing officer to do in these cases.
Okay.
Anything else?
I have nothing. There's nothing that says you have to exhaust every minute.
I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hafter, do you have co-counsel sitting in the audience?
God willing, I hope he never becomes co-counsel. He should be going to a better profession, but my son is sitting in the office.
Would you like to introduce him to us?
Gabriel Hafter, 11 years old.
Nice to meet you, and thank you for coming. You may proceed.
Thank you. I appreciate all of your comments. First off, I'd like to remind the court that out of the adjudicating board members, 50% of them were not physicians. Two out of the four adjudicating members were not physicians. So the concept of self-regulation and deference to physicians kind of goes out of the window. Plus, in this case, we're dealing with something that affects the reputation of the medical profession as a whole. Well, begs the question, is that the reputation that doctors have of themselves or doctors' reputation amongst the community? Because if it's of the community, then we need to give deference to hearing officers and non-physician members, not physicians. And so I'd like to make that point. Second of all, the hearing officer role under 630 is actually very interesting because you don't have to have a hearing officer. Matter of fact, throughout the entire Administrative Code section of 630 and is the statutes, a hearing officer is interchangeable with the board itself or a panel of board members. Any of those three can engage in motion practice related to the formal complaint, can engage in the fact-finding, and have a hearing. So to make this kind of argument that the hearing officer's hands are handcuffed, it is really not within the statutory confines of 630. But in this case, on page 11 of our opening brief, we set through numerous facts that the hearing officer made credibility determinations on of the witnesses. And it wasn't like the hearing officer made a couple findings. The hearing officer wrote a very lengthy opinion, finding numerous credibility issues with the family of the patient. And those were all highlighted on page 11 of my opening brief. I find it interesting that, Mr. Van Rye's response to the comment about taking one count and then some lay member adding their own twist at the end of the motion and saying, well, that's perfectly acceptable because if we were to criticize her for doing that, it would be twisting the law and inappropriate. No, that's the essence of making a motion. You can't make a motion in a public meeting and say that it's the doctor is guilty of doing X because it caused a deviation in the standard of care, adverse patient harm, and then later issue some kind of findings of fact and order that cleans it up and makes it look all proper within the confines of what they feel will pass muster under a judicial review. That just defeats the purpose of having an open meeting law hearing. And finally, I need to go back to this point about the utter failure to adopt a code of ethics. It really does beg the question of, as we just discussed a minute earlier, is disrepute in the mind of the public or is it disrepute in the mind of physicians? 2 weeks ago, I went with my son, Gabriel, to a doctor's appointment. We waited for 2 hours to see the doctor. past the appointment time. Waiting 2 hours, does that bring a doctor into disrepute? Or are doctors always just so tardy that we expect to wait when we go to a doctor? Is that something that we should be filing medical board complaints for? Lying? If a doctor commits adultery, if a doctor engages in an extramarital affair, if a doctor engages in other types of behavior that certain social norms may not accept, but others do, does Dr. Hafter watch his back for the medical board on that? These are questions that really need to be answered and could have been by the adopting of a code of ethics that has never been done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This case will stand submitted and will be at ease until the next counsel for the next matter comes.